The rise of the Internet has helped create a world of citizen journalists who report on events around the world, but Iraq may seem like a strange place to find one. It's one of the most dangerous countries in the world for journalists and unaffiliated visitors. Michael Yon has spent most of the past 3 years blogging about the war. He's been embedded with U.S. forces much of that time. We spoke to him back in February. He's out now with a new book called Moment of Truth in Iraq and joins us here in the Knight Studio at the Newseum. And Michael Yon, nice to see you in person. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks for having me on. It's great to be back in the United States. I just got back about 10 days ago or so after my last two-month trip over there.
If you'd like to talk with Michael Yon about his experiences with U.S. troops in Iraq, give us a phone call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. There's a conversation underway on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And, of course, we'll take questions from the studio audience here at the Newseum. But first of all, Michael Yon, unaffiliated, you don't work for any news organization?
No, I don't. Sometimes I'll write for mainstream, for instance. I had an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal about 2 weeks ago or so. But that's about it. I usually just post to my blog. You see, I've got a new book, but mostly just straight to my blog.
And you fund yourself how? How do you pay for this?
Well, for my first 7 months back in 2005, I paid for it out of my own pocket. And then that got very expensive, as you can imagine.
I can understand, yes.
So I put up a PayPal button, which was very effective, and that kept me going. So after the first long trip to Iraq, which lasted about 8 months, I went over to Afghanistan and just continued to report from the, you know, based on viewer support.
And why do you do it?
Well, I lost several friends to the war. One friend was a Polish writer named Beata Pawlik. She was killed in the Bali bombing, in which about 200 people were killed. And then I lost a friend, I was in Special Forces myself, lost an old Special Forces friend in Iraq on March 30th, 2004, Richard Ferguson, killed in Samarra. And the next day I lost another friend, Scott Helvenston, who was one of the Blackwater contractors murdered in Fallujah when they mutilated the bodies. So I went to those funerals in Colorado and Florida. And then when I was at those funerals, ex-military people kept telling me, you should go to the war and report on it because the story's not being told. And I said, no thanks, I'm not going to the war. And it's just not happening. And so, but that was April of 2004 when, you know, we started to flatten Fallujah the first time, which was obviously a massive overreaction. And then we, you know, the Abu Ghraib photos broke that month, and clearly something was going wrong. And then in November of 2004, you know, the second flattening of Fallujah, Operation Phantom Fury began, and that was when I realized we were losing the war. And so I went there in December, and I stayed most of 2005.
And you were, as your comments suggest, highly critical of how the war was being conducted, but very supportive of those fighting it.
Right. The troops' professionalism was obvious. I mean, that was very clear. It was actually much higher than I would have ever expected. They were doing a fine job, and they were trying to morph to the situation as it morphed. But, you know, when we first went in, few people expected there would be such a massive insurgency, or so many insurgencies, actually. And so it took a while to adjust to that situation, which they've effectively done by now.
And you are, at least according to your op-ed in the Wall Street Journal the other day, an unabashed supporter of the surge.
Yeah, well, it's been very effective. Not just the surge, but the Anbar Awakening, which began in 2006, was also part of the growing success. But the surge and also the change in the tactics in 2007 in particular, pushing the troops out to combat outposts or what they call COPs, has been very effective in generating intelligence, which has been used to target terrorists. And also the civic action programs have been very effective.
General Petraeus, responsible for at least many of those innovations, and again, you're a supporter of his. We just heard today news from Secretary of Defense Robert Gates that General Petraeus will be promoted and be the head of CENTCOM now, overall in charge of Iraq, but not the guy on the ground with the troops there. I know you've been in this country for the past 10 days, but what do you think the effect on morale of U.S. forces might be?
I think it's a very good move to move General Petraeus to CENTCOM. I first heard about that about 3 days ago, and I was curious if he would actually be moved to CENTCOM, but I saw on C-SPAN this morning that he is, and Odierno is going to the...
That's Ray Odierno, his deputy.
Right, is taking his position, taking Petraeus' old position in Baghdad. But I think moving Petraeus to CENTCOM is very good because that also has responsibility for Afghanistan, and the war is going very poorly in Afghanistan, so I think it could be a very good thing.
And I gather you're thinking about heading to Afghanistan next.
Right. I went to Afghanistan first in 2006 and reported there. I was unembedded, actually. I did not go with any U.S. any military at all. But I've left my gear actually in Iraq. I'm going back there shortly. And then after that, over to Afghanistan.
Well, let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. Again, our guest is Michael Yon, blogger and photographer in Iraq and author of the book Moment of Truth in Iraq. He's with us here at the museum, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And let's start with Bob. And Bob's with us from Nevada City in California.
Yeah, it's Rob, but that's all right.
All right, apologize for that.
Okay, I do have a question. It seems you were embedded in Iraq, and I was wondering if the troops, if they have time for it, do they have access to alternative points of view in the media, such as C-SPAN or other media?
They do. On some of the what they call nipper lines or internet connections, their civilian internet connections. Some sites are blocked, but mostly everything is open because they can buy their own internet connections. They can buy their own satellite links.
Like cable television that's being shown in barracks, is anything besides Fox or shown? Or?
You can watch anything you want because you can buy your own satellite. I mean, if you're on a base where you're actually sitting still, some units move around a lot, so they don't have the opportunity. But, yeah, you can buy your own satellite dishes, and you can if you're on a trailer and you can watch anything you want, you can get your own internet connections, satellite connections, and surf the net.
Those nipper lines don't pipe in National Public Radio?
Actually, I've heard NPR over there quite a lot.
So. Okay. Rob, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let's see if we can go now to Chuck. Chuck's calling us from San Francisco.
Thanks a lot. I just want to say I have a lot of respect and gratitude to people in the military who put themselves in harm's way for their fellow citizens and for larger causes. But that said, my question is, did you notice a erosion of what I had believed was traditionally a firewall between, how effective a firewall is up to debate, but a firewall between domestic politics and the military? I've heard of a lot of, political litmus tests being applied to folks in the Justice Department and in Iraq reconstruction teams and so forth. And I think there's been an attempt to identify the troops with a certain political platform by people who are standing on that political platform. And I'm wondering if you saw an erosion or if you've seen any pressure to conform to a particular party line and during your time with the troops.
They don't really talk politics much unless, maybe sometimes somebody cusses at the president or something. The troops are focused on the war. Most of them are actually success oriented at this point. They see that there's growing success, that the violence is down dramatically. So they don't really get into the nitty gritty. They're focused on what's at hand, and it's life and death situations. So you're not really thinking about what's going on back in Pennsylvania.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chuck. You mentioned, of course, that violence has gone down considerably since the start of the surge, but a contributing factor to that was the ceasefire ordered by Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shiite cleric who controls the Sadr army. Things have seemingly heated up over the past several weeks as the Iraqi government and U.S. forces, too, have put pressure on the Mahdi army and Sadr organization. It sometimes threatens to open a conflict. This could be a resumption of the kind of civil war that drove up casualties, made a lot of violence happen, and the U.S. forces could be caught in the middle again. A lot of people are worried about that.
Yes, but it's got a different face. There's many constituents of the war. For instance, the tribal issues in places like Anbar, have abated. Those were Sunni tribes mostly. That pushed al-Qaeda out of Anbar into South Baghdad and Arab Jabur and Bakuba and places like that. Al-Qaeda in particular was trying to foment civil war, and they were successful. And I was the first to report that, in fact, in February of 2005. It didn't really kick off big until 2006. But al-Qaeda also helped strengthen JAM or Jaish al-Mahdi, the Sadrs, by actually attacking them. And so, but we've attrited al-Qaeda so much at this point that they're still effective. They're still killing people daily. But there's not a lot left of them compared to yesteryear. So the biggest issue now is JAM and the special groups in particular who seem to be supported by Iran, for instance, who seems to be supplying them with EFPs, which is a certain type of bomb that's very effective.
And these would be Shia groups.
Shia groups.
And supported by Iran. And so there's an intra-Shia conflict underway here between, well, the prime minister is a member of the Dawa party, and he, of course, that party has its own militia. There's the Skiri group that's
right.
They've got their own militia, the Badr Brigades, and they mentioned the Mahdi army. Is this going to be resolved anytime soon?
Well, a lot of this is obviously political posturing. It's unlike al-Qaeda, so this is a very important thing to keep in mind. We cannot negotiate with al-Qaeda. You just have to fight them. But with the JAM militias, generally speaking, you can negotiate. They use violence as a negotiating tactic. And so it's not necessarily, this is not going the way of the Civil War. The Civil War really has ended.
Our guest, Michael Yan, a reporter and blogger, a citizen blogger from Iraq. His book, Moment of Truth in Iraq. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. Bill with us from Stockton, California.
Hello there. My question is a little bit different. I'm wondering if what you see on the ground there in the battle zones, the communities and so forth, is significantly the same or significantly different from what seems to be reported back to us here via mainstream news.
What do you think, Michael Yan?
Well, there's the problem with reporting from the war. First of all, it's the most dangerous war in history for journalists. More journalists have been killed in this war than even World War II, mostly Iraqi journalists. And it's also very, very tough living. I've been over there for more than 600 days, and I can tell you it's not a fun place to be. And so you don't have many journalists who stick it out, who develop the context that takes to actually report effectively, because it takes a great deal of time traveling into the Shia groups down in Basra, for instance, traveling into the places like Anbar province or Babil province or Diyala province. All these, they have different faces. The war has many different faces. And
is it possible for you to travel in those places except in the company of American troops?
You can, but you're risking death. Stephen Vincent, for instance, was murdered in Basra. He was an independent journalist. You can go up to the Kurdish regions. I was just there as I was leaving. You can go up there on vacation. It's actually quite safe. And so you don't need any guards. You don't need any weapons. They treat you very well. But in most of the other places, you might be able to do that in the next year or so in Anbar province, but only time will tell. Maybe that's a little stretch to say that. We'll have to wait and see.
And I wonder, do you think that, and Bill, thanks very much for the call, do you wonder that your point of view is colored by the fact that you're standing with American troops?
Oh, absolutely it is. I mean, but you can't get out of that without being killed. I mean, and you might be killed in it. So it's Now, I went to Afghanistan completely unembedded. I went there without U.S. military or British. But at the same time, you can't. The risk I was taking in Afghanistan were so severe that if I continued, I wouldn't be here right now. So, what are you going to do? Take what vantage point you can actually get.
So. Let's talk with Steve, and Steve's calling us from Wichita in Kansas.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead,
Michael. I had a question. A lot of the conservative talk show hosts here in the United States have equated being against the policies and the war as being against the troops, and that people who talk negatively about the war are hurting the morale of the troops. I was wondering if you got any sense of how the American soldiers over there were feeling about people criticizing the war and criticizing the policies, whether or not they felt personally insulted by that.
You know, this is something that's been discussed really almost ad nauseum since 2003. But at this point, I mean, it's a very good question, though. It always remains open. But I would say that at this point, it's become background noise to the troops. It used to be a very serious topic of discussion, but now it's just something they've grown accustomed to and sort of ignore.
So when they hear that 60% or two-thirds of the American public now thinks the war was a bad idea, they just shrug?
More or less, they're getting to be like that. I wouldn't say entirely. I mean, certainly it affects them somewhat. But they've really kind of consigned themselves that that's just part of the landscape. You know, some of these people are on their fourth tour at this point. And, you know, many are on their third tour. Very few are on their fourth tour or fifth, but there are many that are on their second and third tours. And after you see so much of the war, you do start to take some of these things in stride.
And obviously the situation has been extant for some time.
Right. And you mean in regard to the background noise?
Sure, yeah.
Right. Since at least 2003, you know, it's just been part of the territory. And so it's, what can you do with it? So,
Steve, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And Michael Yon, thanks so much for dropping by and speaking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
And good luck when you go back to Iraq and then on to Afghanistan.
Thank you.
Michael Yon's book is Moment of Truth in Iraq, and he joined us here at the museum. Our broadcast today was produced by Susan Lund and David Gura. Drew Reynolds is our technical director. He got help today from Kurt Stalnicker, Neil Ellis, and Jerry Tennant. We'd also like to thank the entire team here at the museum for their hospitality. Charles Overby, CEO, Jack Hurley, and Susan Bennett, deputy directors, Shelby Coffey, senior fellow at the museum. Also, Jim Updike, Dennis Dunbar, Tim Lawrence, and Walt Hassett on the technical side, and our thanks to them all. Tomorrow, before sex, drugs, and rock and roll, there were comic books. More tomorrow on the 10-cent plague, the great comic book scare, and how it changed America. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan at the museum in Washington, D.C.